thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. It's really always exciting to talk about author identifiers. The only regret I have is that ORCID, unfortunately, is still an idea, so it's not a service you can use today, but you have to wait a few more months. So hopefully this summer you can start actually registering ORCID IDs and using the system. So a little more time. So this will be a presentation about some basic ideas in the ORCID service and status report of what's happening and what will happen next. I am a researcher and medical doctor from Hanover Medical School, and I also sit on the ORCID board. And as everybody else involved in ORCID, I'm doing this sort of as a voluntary work because I think author identification is important. But just to understand my background, that I'm interested in using author identifiers as a researcher because I hope it will make my life easier and more interesting. And this morning we already have talked about the problem that names are usually not good enough to identify a particular person, especially if the name is Smith or Kim, and that algorithms, so that computers can do this automatically only 90% of the time, so that you really need a unique number for every author if you want to have a system that you can trust, where you build connections between authors and their publications and their institutions and their other scholarly outputs. And right now, I think it's fair to say that this system doesn't exist and that the scholarly record, that's one way to describe the system, is broken. And of course, what we want is a system where institutions on the left have information from publications and from publishers on the top right, from grants, from funding agencies on the lower right, and that this information is sort of connected. And for this, you need two things. One is unique identifiers for authors, but also unique identifiers for research works. So the ISBN for books, the DOI for journal articles are standard now, and there are new initiatives like DataCite issuing DOIs for data sets. And that's sort of a requirement if you want to build this connected system. And the other requirement is, of course, that these different systems, and there are many, many systems, that they have to talk to each other. So there's no use in having a number for every researcher if you cannot use this number in your university system or your publishing system. So there's actually two aspects to that. But I don't want to talk about these more general questions because that's not really specific to ORCID, but rather talk about what's the approach that ORCID has taken to try to solve this, and whether it's able to solve this, we will see in a few years. And the first question is, of course, why do you need ORCID? Because there are so many other initiatives already. Some of them were mentioned this morning, especially ISNI and REPIC and AuthorClaim. And for ORCID, two aspects are very important. One is that it's open, and secondly, that it's comprehensive. Open means that it's not a system that only limited number of organizations can participate in, or limited number of researchers, that the data are openly available, that the source code of the software that's running this service will be open source, and similar aspects, and I will go into this a little bit more in detail in a few minutes. And also, ORCID aims to be comprehensive. So it's not limited to physics or economics or specific country. I mean, there are many successful author identifiers that work because they are smaller in scale. So we have heard economics for REPIC. We have Brazil and the Netherlands that have successful national author identifier systems. But Usually that doesn't work because research is international. There are collaborations across disciplines, across institutions, across countries. Comprehensive also means that it's not an isolated author identifier system, but it aims to talk to all the other author identifier services that are out there. And I will also go a little bit more detail about this. And lastly, comprehensive means that ORCID aims not only to provide an identifier, but really to work with all these organizations that want to use author identifiers to integrate into their systems. ORCID has set up a set of 10 principles that's really guiding the initiatives, and I suggest you take a look on the ORCID website if you find this more interesting. And one of them is really what I just said. ORCID is not really limited to specific geographic region or specific discipline. And one way to show is that to show this map of the organizations that are participating in ORCID, there should be a little orange for Lithuania, but you probably cannot see it from here. But you really see that the organization that support ORCID as participants are coming from all over the world. And that is one important factor of making this identifier successful. The same is true for the kind of organizations who are supporting ORCID. The largest number is really academic organizations like universities and research institutes. But there's also support from all the other groups that are interested in scholarly communication, whether it's societies, whether it's publishers, whether it's nonprofit organizations, government organizations, and other organizations that sort of run a business in this space. And ORCID is not really limited to any of those. And this is also true for the board of directors. So right now, ORCID is an organization where everybody can say we want to participate, but sort of the day-to-day business until there's ORCID staff is really decisions are made by the board of directors. That's 14 organizations. And you see they're really coming from different directions. So it's not just academic institutions or libraries or funding organizations or publishers, but it's really a good mix. And the ORCID principles say that the majority will always be non-for-profit. That's, of course, also the case right now. And you also see OCLC as one of the board members. And this probably just exemplifies that isn't an ORCID are just two related initiatives, but there's constant talk between these two. I mentioned this before, the data that ORCID provides are open, so all the data in the database will be provided under a Creative Commons Zero waiver, and the software, when it's ready, will be provided as open source software. The devil's in the details. There's one little problem with opening data. And Thomas Krischel will not like this, but one other important principle for ORCID is that this has to be a sustainable organization, which means it has to have set up membership fees so that this infrastructure and the development costs and all this can run. And so there are some limitations in what only members can do, because otherwise nobody would be willing to pay for the ORCID service. So all the data will be free, but then the question is, will it be the data that is current as of now, or will it be a data set that is a few months old? But basically, if you're interested in using the data, you can do this as a data dump. And importantly, ORCID will always be free for an individual researcher. So a researcher can go to the website and register for an ORCID identifier and can always control the privacy. So the kind of information that is visible to everybody. And there's, of course, sensitive information like email addresses that you don't want to share on the open web. And we had this discussion before lunch that it's probably not realistic that 5 years from now there will be only one author identifier system. And I think there will also be not two, but there will be many, because many of them work perfectly already for a very specific purpose. We heard about Repack. And there are other disciplines that have their own author identifier schemes. So, for example, low right, the high energy physics, the Inspire system. So they have solved the problem for their discipline. And of course, ORCID doesn't want to reinvent the wheel, but rather work with these systems together so that there's exchange of information between the different services. And I think that's one important role for ORCID, is really to connect these things together, because right now Inspire, well, there's probably not too much overlap with RAPEC, but Inspire connected to Scopus, connected to Researcher ID and so forth, that's right now is not really happening, and ORCID can really be a bridge for that. And this is just an example of what you can do. Why this would be useful to have an identifier. And again, this is not only about issuing ID, but also you have to make all these systems use this ID. So the most important use case right now to get the system started is actually the one at the bottom. So manuscript submission is important use case. When you submit a manuscript to a journal, you also provide your ORCID ID, and this will make it easier for the author, because you don't have to provide your institutional affiliation, all the other information, and it also makes life easier for the journal. For example, to figure out whether this, if you look for reviewers, whether this author has co-authored a paper with potential reviewers and so forth. Similarly, grant applications is something that makes it easier for both the funding organizations and the researcher if you just provide a number instead of all kinds of information. And for grants, there's something else, which is usually you have to provide a CV, so a list of all your publications. And if you can make it easier to generate that list, that is, of course, also helpful. And of course, universities want to see what their faculty is doing, and right now this is really difficult just to find out what the publications are of your faculty. Some universities are better than others, but there are many large universities that just don't know what their faculty is doing, and of course ORCID is helping in doing this, and this again is something that is helpful for both the researcher and the institution. And just to take the example of a manuscript submission, this is the workflow that we envision, which is that on the lower right, you submit a manuscript to a publisher, and either you have an ORCID ID already or the publisher asks you to go and register. And the idea is that this is voluntary, so this is not a requirement, but this will make it easier, so we expect that most people will be doing this. And then once the manuscript hopefully is accepted and published, the information, the ORCID identifier connected to the manuscript will be passed on with the DOI to Crossref as a central database of publications. And from there, this connection will move on to the ORCID system. So there's different systems talking to each other, and I think that's one of the strengths of ORCID, to make all this work together and not just have the number at one place. And of course then this in effect means when you publish a paper that automatically appears in your ORCID profile, and your institution automatically is notified that you have published this paper. Now, I mentioned at the beginning that ORCID is a system which you cannot use as of today, but you have to wait. If you're a research institution, you have to wait a few months. The service launch is planned for sometime this summer. And ORCID is really something that has gone on now for a little bit over 2 years, and is a nonprofit organization for a little bit over a year, and has three working groups: business working group, technical working group, and outreach working group, all working on a voluntary basis to move this forward. And my position is to chair this outreach working group. This is just a brief timeline of what we have done in 2011 and what will be happening this year. On top, you see, I hope you see, build phase one, which means the first version of the software is under development and will be done at the end of March, hopefully, and then there will be minor adjustments to make the software ready for production service. You also see that there is phase two, so the next version of the software will be developed after the service launches, so some features will not be available this summer, will come later. I talk about that briefly. And you also see that the API is already released. So if you're a developer, you don't have to wait for the summer, but you can start developing now, and I will briefly talk about this. So start registering ORCIDs will happen in the summer. And ORCID is hoping to start collecting membership fees in 2013, so not this year. But sort of the service will start this year, and then after a few months, ORCID will also be charging membership fees, basically to support the cost of all this. And one important factor is, of course, that you need staff to run a service, and ORCID right now is working hard to hire a first staff as an executive director and a technical director, and probably a few more staff over the coming year. And the sort of first version of the ORCID software that has been mentioned before is really, there's a type of the researcher ID software license from Thomson Reuters and modified for the use by the ORCID system, and that these modifications is basically development work that's taking place right now and should be finished next month. And importantly, the software then will also be open source software, will really be released. Because of these roots, ORCID, the ORCID phase one system is basically similar to ResearchID, a self-claim system for researchers, because that's what ResearchID was built for. So as a researcher, you can go to the website, register, and claim your publications. And the system will also allow institutions to do that for their researchers. But that's sort of the main functionality of the first version of the service, and that's important to keep in mind if you are not an institution, that you cannot really put data, I mean, of authors into the system unless it's via the authors. The documentation for the programming interfaces is available at this link below, and there's also links, of course, at the ORCID website, and there's also a mock API server, mock meaning the server responds to all these API requests, but it always returns one single researcher. And what the API can do is several things. It's actually three APIs. This is the one querying the ORCID service, so asking for information, and then you can do several things. This is including, you have an ORCID ID and you want to know more about the person, like name and affiliation. You want to know the publications of this person. And of course, you can go the other way around and say, here I have a DOI for a paper. Please tell me who are the authors and what are their ORCID IDs. And of course, this is necessary to integrate ORCID into your own system. The second API is the deposit API, so adding information to the ORCID service. And the third API is the search, so that you can also, of course, search for things in the system. And the API specification, as I said, has been finalized for query and deposit and is available for reading. And you can download this mock server, as I did here, install it on a system and start developing. And the only researcher in the system is Josiah Carberry, and that's his ORCID ID there. And Josiah Carberry is a person you meet a lot when you hear about ORCID. That's basically a fictional professor invented at Brown University in the U.S. 80 years ago. So his field of study is psychoceramics. So if you hear about Josiah Carberry or the journal Psychoceramics, then keep in mind these people don't exist, which means he will never get an ORCID. He has to apply for an ISNI, or somebody has to do that, because that's a fictional character. And based on the specification of the software and also what is sort of the easiest to do, where should you start, the main use cases this year for ORCID is really new content. So when you submit a manuscript, you submit a grant, you submit a data set, at this time you ask for an ORCID ID, and that this information will be added to the system. And also the second use case that's really easy to do is when you already have claimed content, meaning when you already know that this person has authored these 25 papers, you can add this to the service. And this could be information from other author identifier systems, or this could be from universities that keep track of their researchers. So maybe libraries or administrations that know the research output of their research, and as I said before, that's not true for all universities. In 2012, it might be too early for a university who doesn't have this information to start the ORCID system and claiming this, because that's more difficult to do, and it's probably more a use case for 2013 onwards. But of course, it shouldn't stop anybody from using ORCID as soon as the service is launched. It's just not expected that it's expected that these use cases will be there first. And because on the focus on researchers, basically the history of the service, and also in general, you cannot really create an identifier about a person without the person itself being involved, there really has to be a focus, and ORCID is trying to do that, on helping the researcher. So ORCID will only be successful if it really solves problems that researchers have. And journal submission is a problem for many reasons, but one aspect which is nasty: when you're ready with your manuscript, you finally want to submit it, that you have to go through all kinds of hoops, technical issues to make this work, and even worse is grant applications, where everybody wants a slightly different looking list of your publications. And if ORCID can help with these kinds of problems, then researchers will use the service. Of course, the service also has to be usable, so this is not something for somebody who spends this whole day on using these kinds of systems, but the web interfaces, for example, to register for a new ORCID ID, that's really important to make this work right. It's important to respect privacy, obviously, because this is about personal information, and this, for example, means that ORCID isn't really interested in things like date of birth or place of birth, because that's very sensitive information, which is difficult to make sure that this stays private. And also, it's just, if you want to make these data open, then there's no place for things like date of birth. And it's important that the service allows participation by researchers. And this can be simple things as just requests of problems with the service or just suggestions, but this also means that researchers have to be involved of the direction of what the service is taking, future features, and so forth. And that's actually very difficult to do because researchers don't have the same kind of organization as a university administration, libraries, or publishers, but there are just many of them, and it's not easy to make the system, I mean, make their voice heard. The Orkut identifier will actually look quite similar to an ISNI, which is 16 digits. And the idea, like everything else on the web, is that it's not just a number, but it's rather a URL, a link. And you see that it starts with orkut.org, which means that starting this week, the Orkut website has changed its name. So it's now, if you want to learn more about Orkut, you go to about.orkut.org. Right now you're redirected, so don't worry, but the reason is that we really want to have these nice URLs for researchers when we launch in the summer. It's important to stress that Orkut is not solving all problems, but it's really one step forward. So there are several things that Orkut is not. It's not a service to replace all existing author identifiers, and we have talked about this before. This is just another one which tries to play nicely with those that are out there or are evolving, like ISNI. And Orkut focuses very much on active researchers. So at least the first version of the system isn't really built for listing the works of inactive or even deceased authors, people that have published 20 or 50 years ago. This might be something that will be added later, but right now it's just not the focus of the service. Orkut is not, or the Orkut Phase 1 system that's launching this summer, is not a service to disambiguate author profiles. I will come to that, back to that in a minute. And the last two are important. Orkut is not an authentication service. So the Orkut ID and password is not intended to be used to authenticate on all kinds of places. It's technically possible to do that, but it's just is a whole different story. It's related, but it's something, it's a different problem, and it's just not, at least for now, is not in scope for what Orkut tries to do. And similarly, Orkut is not a service that provides unique identifiers for institutions. We heard before that ISNI and NISO and also ARIF, mentioned by Thomas Krechel, there are other solutions for this, and Orkut is not really trying to build that into its system. The next version of the software, which will be hopefully launching next year, will mainly, main difference will be disambiguation, which is, as we have heard this morning, difficult to do. And there are different aspects of how you can disambiguate. Right now, the first version of the service is really on the left, that basically researcher says, these are my publications. Or the, maybe the institution says that for the researcher, but that other people say, yeah, that's really true, whether it's the publisher or the co-authors. All this information requires a very different software architecture that will happen next year. And this phase two system will then allow other organizations to add data to the system. Right now, if the first version of the system would allow that, that would be just a disambiguation nightmare if universities, publishers, funding organizations, all of them would submit data about a person at the same time, then this is really difficult, and you need this special software for this, which will then deduplicate, really say, well, this is actually the same person. And then, of course, this will also help to verify what the researcher said, whether we really authored that paper or is really working at this institution. What Orkut really wants to do is also to connect researchers with non-publication contributions. So we heard a lot about data sets already. And the focus right now is really on publications. So that's just, I should finish. And also ORCID is interested in a later stage to also capture the roles that contributors have. We have heard about this before. So Mike Taylor said we're interested to say, well, this is the contribution of the author is really that he programmed the part or that he did data analysis and all this kind of information. It's very interesting, but requires a special software. I think it's two more slides. The question, of course, is who's paying for all this? ORCID is a nonprofit organization, so it's not interested in earning money or setting up an author identity fair service, but it still costs money. And ORCID has decided to do this by membership fees. So you get benefits if you're a member, and this depends on whether you're a university or a publisher, what you can do with a membership, because there are different things you're interested in. There will be no membership fees in 2012, and there will be no transaction costs. So it will not be that for every researcher you register, there will be a certain fee, or for every query in the database, but it will be just be a membership fee that an institution pays per year. And this fee, of course, depends on whether you are small or big, whether you're a nonprofit or a commercial entity. And for now, meaning 2011-2012, ORCID really depends on donations, grants, and loans to really get started, because it's a catch-22. People only pay for a service that is running, but of course you cannot set up the service without developing the software, without hiring staff, and so forth. And finally, if you want to find out more, of course, I hope we have a discussion, or you talk to me after the session. You can probably best place to start is the ORCID website. There's also mailing list, and of course there's a Twitter account, and the next ORCID outreach meeting is in May in Cambridge in the United States, and the next European outreach meeting has not been scheduled yet, but will be before the end of the year, because it's usually two meetings a year, and one of them will be in Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And now the talk is open for discussions and questions. Please.
What approximately the membership fee will be, and what those who are members will receive in general? Saying.
I mean, that's a difficult discussion. So the membership fees range somewhere from, let's say, 500 euro to 50,000 euro. But 50,000 euro is really for Elsevier or a large funding organization. So for a small university, this will be maybe 500 or 1,000 euro per year. What was the second part of the question?
What will receive those who are members?
What will it?
Why to be the member?
Well, for a university, this means if you want to create ORCID IDs for your researchers and don't want them to do that themselves, for this you need to be a member. So you cannot go there and create ORCID IDs if you're not a member. This also means that then you're sure that every or in your faculty has an ORCID ID, and that you can use the numbers in your library system and so forth, in your repository and other places. So you could just, if you don't want to pay the membership fee, you can just tell your researchers to do all that, but then it's just a slower process.
Thank you. Any other questions? No questions? Unbelievable. ORCID is up to be launched in a few months from now, and we have no questions. Okay, then I have one question. How many researchers worldwide in EU or in German knows anything about ORCID right now, and how many will do in a year or two from now?
I think the number will be very small. Right now, ORCID is not something that researchers should worry about because it's not something they can use. So the focus has really been on other aspects in the outreach, which is to make decisions about the technical development and to move forward and to about the business model. And I think it's much easier to promote something where a researcher can go and use. So that will change this summer. It's difficult to predict how many researchers will know about ORCID in 12 months or in 2 years. I personally think that this will be a slow process. So it's not that I expect that 1 year from now there will be 1 million people that have registered, but that will take longer. But it just has to start somewhere, like everything.
Please.
If the researcher goes to ORCID, so ORCID is running, and the researcher goes to ORCID and he gets information about his publications, and you said that ORCID will be linked with other databases. So does it mean, for example, if our university is subscribing only to Scopus database, will the researcher be able to get the data also about his publications from Thomson Reuters, from Easy Web of Knowledge?
Well, the primary mechanism to get publications into ORCID is via Crossref, which is sort of for publications is, I guess, a standard mechanism. And but somebody has to really go there and say, these are the publications of the researcher. If the researcher is not doing this, then the university has to wait until new publications appear in the system. But for a paper that was published 5 years ago, somebody has to say this is really the author, and Web of Science and Scopus will probably not do that because they don't really know who the author is, because they just know 90% of the time.
So it will actually start working in, as you said, in 2013. So what is in there for a researcher?
So in the beginning, it will be...
What will you get out of that?
That's why I said I think this will take some time to grow, because in the beginning, if you register a researcher, it's just a number.
Okay.
So you can, as a researcher, you can say, I claim these publications, and then there's an interface to look up your papers in Crossref, similar to what AuthorClaim is doing, or you import your profile from AuthorClaim or from another service. Or you wait until you publish new papers and they have an ORCID idea associated with them.
Thank you.
Please, your question.
Yeah, I understood the plan was to use the SIG system of Crossref. That's still the case, right? So you're going to use the SIG. It's basically a database you can launch queries to. So Crossref do have a freely available database where you can actually make queries for Crossref data. I use that actually in AuthorClaim. So people who are registered with AuthorClaim and have claimed some paper, what I do is I take that data and I massage it. And then I have a robot asking questions to SIG. And it will take keywords and get them back from SIG. So it will do an automated way. But if you don't have that, then you'll be relying on formulating queries that will give you back the data on your publications, right? So if you say Krichel and you were working whatever Krichel and you know you've been working on time consistency, you'll be having Krichel time consistency and you'll be getting back some papers, right? So if you're Chen and you've been working on nationalism, then it's going to be more difficult. I mean, in any system that you're going to be doing per claims, you're going to be having to do some searches. I mean, this is always going to be here.
But I think it's important to make a distinction between papers that have been published already and then going back. And that's painful, and somebody has to decide this is really a researcher, and it's more difficult the longer back you go. So a paper published 100 years ago might be both more difficult and less interesting, and something that is published from now onwards. And I think the strength of ORCID is really that you start using these numbers, and then a few years from now, everything falls into place. And until then, you have to decide as an institution whether you just wait until there's enough papers in the system, or whether you go actively backwards and or let your researchers claim that. That's a decision the institution will have to make. And that's why I think that ORCID is more interesting for research institutions a few years later. Maybe next year is much more interesting than at the very first day the service launches.
And sorry, I still don't understand. That means that the researcher registers himself and he registers his works? Because I thought that it's a database which would withdraw the list of his publications.
Yeah, but that's the whole problem of who is really 100% certain that this is the publication of this author. So we only have systems that do this automatically, and they are... So what will happen is that you get a list of 10 papers as suggestion, and you say, well, actually 8 of these 10 are from me, and the other 2 are a different Mike Taylor, for example.
Okay,
somebody has to make this decision, and the author is probably still the best person to do that, not some computer or somebody else for him.
I think I understood now. Thank you.
Can I? Yeah, so to add to this, I mean, as I talked about in my own presentation, even from this very early stage, because the functionality in the ORCID service, I think a lot of interest will sort of be generated from the researcher side through these various specialized like ORCID apps that will actually make use of these IDs directly. Not so much to go back in time to figure out who wrote what years ago, but more for this new content, especially these sort of non-publication, unconventional kinds of contributions. And we see a lot of interest in doing that sort of thing around us, and we have a number of projects in the works that will do this later in the year.
Sorry, it wasn't a question, it was a follow-up point. Just to reiterate that Scopus will, at the moment that ORCID launches, have a link to export publications from Scopus to ORCID, and that people will be able to clean up the accuracy of those record before it gets exported. It is very, very difficult to automatically create records that have every single publication and no omissions and no incorrect inclusions, which is why we have to have that cleaning stage. The degree of accuracy has gone up quite substantially. I measure it independently. Over the last year, and I'm expecting another really good increase in the amount of accuracy in our data records later this year. It is something we take exceedingly seriously, and it is something that we are investing in very heavily to ensure that the data that we have is in the best possible state so that it can be submitted to ORCID without extra work. But it is not, as I've explained with the competing Mike Taylors, and everybody will give you examples of data that isn't 100% right. It is always going to be an approximate solution. There is never going to be an exact solution until we have the benefit of the ORCIDs. But one of the things that is truly great about the openness of the ORCID situation is that as people clean those up, so all the people who have a relationship with ORCID have a data supply of cleaned up data, which can be fed back into the software that we use to create the author profiles in the first place. And this is the case for all of the people who contribute data to ORCID. So, for example, if I go onto Scopus and I include my publications and remove the one fake one, then that gets fed back to the top of the Scopus algorithm. That information is taken as being a fact
we do a thing called tombstoning, which means it is engraved in stone that this is the fact that this person did not write this paper and should not ever be clustered with that thing. And that piece of information gets fed into all the algorithmic approaches. So in the same way that a butterfly flapping its wings on the other side of the universe can cause a hurricane on the other side of the universe, so all these changes have an incremental effect in improving the data. And that's not just the Elsevier data, that's the data in ORCID and all the people who have a relationship with ORCID.
Thank you. We have a question over here.
I would like to give you one more question from the library world. Do you plan an import option in the database? Because as far as I know, almost all countries have one or another kind of national databases of scholarly publications with all authors identified, and the tremendous jobs are done already. So not to repeat everything again, just to key to ORCID, do you plan to take the data, or import data from ready databases?
Well, I think I try to explain that the first version cannot really handle five people or five organizations submitting data that are conflicting. So that's why the decision is the researcher or the institution. So if the library of an institution has information about the researcher, they can, of course, submit that. And also, if there are changes, do that on behalf of the researchers. But it's different if you have a file of, for example, all publications in a national library from a country, because then you cannot really be sure that the university isn't doing something similar at the same time, and then you start having conflicts. That's the same reason why you don't have import from other large data sources. So for that, you really need the second version of the software. But information that libraries already have, that's definitely, and that's sort of very important to work with libraries, because they're everybody has a different software and a different system, and to make that work is a big job for the next 12 months.
Again, sorry, I'd just like to add to that, just to clarify that although what we're talking about here is for version 2, which is something we're going to be working on or releasing, hoping to release next year, the work for that has been ongoing for the last 9 months. So it's not just a wished for. It is something that we know that has to happen, and we have been working on since the beginning.
You had a question or comment?
Yeah, I'm a bit nervous about asking, because this is going to be a naive question. You said this was ORCID is another IDE. It's not going to replace all the other ones. I'm getting confused with all these IDs. And so question is, why do we need all these different IDs? Is there a simple answer? Why, if ORCID comes along, why can't we that? Do we still need researcher ID and Scopus and this and that? Why can't life be simpler and we just have one ID and we all have that one ID and it all works?
Well, I guess there are two answers. One is that there are just many systems that work perfectly, so why should you stop using them? And mostly it's systems that are specific to discipline or country or... and then there are different use cases. So ORCID is not trying to do everything. You heard about ISNI. ISNI is doing something a little bit different. So there's definitely space for ORCID at ISNI. And similar, AuthorClaim is something doing something slightly different. So there is, like everything else, this is not simple. And I think what is important is really that everything is connected, so that when you have information in one system, then you can say, well, this is the same person as person with this ORCID ID and with this ISNI.
Add to that, I mean, if you just simply look at the record call for surface versus author claim, right, you can say this is based on the same software, developed by the same people, roughly, doing reasonably the same job? Why aren't they, you know, coming together and we just have one? One of the reasons for this is that they don't use the same organizational database. So the back-end institutions to which you're going to be identified is not going to be the same. So even, you know, uniting those two is not a trivial exercise. I'd rather have ORCID doing that for me, right? So that I have, that because they can take in identifiers from a bunch of different systems, right, that even go beyond that, and they would be doing that sort of work.
Yeah. And also to add to what Thomas said, that at the same time, you can focus on doing what you do best, or your system does best, in your community, and not bother with the rest.
Comments?
Yeah, sorry, I have one more thing, because I'd like to say something in the support of the majority of people who have written research works before, scholarly papers. The idea that researchers automatically belong to an institution or a publisher is a very good one, but 90% of the people who have written things that have been published are no longer active. They may be dead, but the normal use case for a person is they write one or two research papers and they never ever publish again. They don't work in academic institutions, they don't have a publisher, they don't have a professional organization. So there's no body there that can claim an ORCID on behalf of somebody who wrote one paper 30 years ago and has never written one again. But we still need to be able to, as Elsevier, if we are going to give you that paper, I still need to tell you something about it, and I still need to be able to identify it. So that number, the Scopus author ID that I have, may never be mapped onto an ORCID, but nevertheless it still needs to be handled in our database in order for us to service our clients.
Can I ask a question too? Because setting up a new service is difficult for many different reasons, technically challenging and getting everybody on the table. But I would be interested in hearing, you know, you sort of suggested to that when you ask about the cost of the service. So is this something you say, oh, I have been waiting for this for 10 years or whatever? Or are you saying, well, this is interesting, let's wait and see? Or you say, I would be using this if only it doesn't cost anything, or if it would be also doing this or that, because this feedback is really important to make this work. This is not something where there's only one right solution. So I would like to, if possible, to hear, well, I would only use ORCID if this would be different, and cost would be a good example, because money, of course, is a big problem in this.
Could anybody answer the question? Yes, please.
Maybe I would like to pose not the question, but only some thoughts. I see that ORCID is very good thing, and I think it will be getting more and more popular in Lithuania. But thinking from the point of money, yes, I would like to ask, how do you think if the appearance of ORCID will help for those who are strong to be stronger more, and for those who are weak or not rich enough to pay what you will require to pay will get weaker because they will not be able to use ORCID service?
I think when we looked at the numbers that this costs, I think that there was agreement that what is important is the beginning, to set this up, the development, and when the service is running, the cost will be less, and also if the number of institutions using ORCID and paying membership fees, if the number is large, then the fee will be very small. So this is really a problem of the next 5 years and not problem in 10 or 20 years. So the solution should really be to make it possible for as many institutions as possible to participate. I think it's obvious to everybody this is not something you can have for free, but it's also clear that rich and large institutions will have to pay more than those that cannot afford this, and there will, I'm sure there will be many ways you can do this, whether it's waiving fees for the first year or whether it's just, I mean, for example, the exact fee has not been set in stone, because that's something we don't know what is realistic, what institutions can pay, or whether there will be other ways. Like I would expect Germany, for example, there might be grants from funding organizations paying for universities and all kinds of other things. So it's really the only reason there needs to be money is to pay for this, not to become rich. So there has to be a solution.
Yeah, I have a kind of a secondary answer to this. So seems to me, although it's not obviously decided yet, that for the like small, much smaller institutions, I mean, we're not talking about massive fees in comparison to CrossFair, for example. I think the for the smallest size of institution there, the annual fee is something like, what, $200, I think it is? Is that right? Yeah, so a couple hundred dollars a year hardly is going to break the bank for a university. So we're talking very small amounts if you're a small organization, surely.
I'm sorry, I keep talking. First of all, of course, ORCID will always be free for individuals to use. The API, the interface, will always be free. The restrictions are in terms of sending bulk quantities of data and pulling back bulk quantities of data. And in particular, when it comes to retrieving data back, what you will be getting is cleaned up data, which comes from more sources than you have already. So you should find that there are real benefits, real cost savings involved in having and in paying for data to come from ORCID. But the important interface and the ability for individuals to use it will always be free. It's not a system that gets cut off.
Okay. Thank you.